I'm going to read a little bit from a man that is a little bit more available to most of our style of thinking and reading, C.S. Lewis, because he has an essay, or it's not an essay, it was a sermon, that he preached in 1939 when England was just going into the war. Carol and I were in Norway at that time, and we had just come out of England. Actually, we were in England in September of 39, and the pressure of that period was unbelievable. Unless you've lived through sandbags and gas masks and the imminent threat of bombing, you hardly can conceive of what the atmosphere is like in a country like England that was suddenly exposed to what looked to be a very immediate kind of attack. And perhaps if Hitler had been able to marshal his forces soon enough, many people feel that if he had done that within a year or two, he could have really controlled England, because she wasn't ready for the war, and that made her even more frightened. Of course, we are all more frightened if we are stuck someplace and don't have anything to do battle with, and and the enemy looks very threatening. This is even more interesting then to realize that this sermon that Lewis preached in 1939 in October to the young students who were just matriculating at the University at Oxford, that he was able to define and explain why it was necessary to learn in wartime. And he makes some very telling applications to us, although he was preaching to them. He's talking about the fact that it seems odd to be students in pursuit of learning at this very radical and frightening time of a war crisis. What is the use of beginning a task which we have so little chance of finishing? Now, most of us who are well beyond the age of discretion and well into the age of non-discretion, particularly the first floor group here, we really could well think that why begin something, why start studying something now when, what chance is there of our finishing it? I one of the great comforts to me is that I think it's Ruth Hamilton, who wrote books after she retired from teaching. Well, I've not been a teacher for a long time, so I guess it's no use for me to think about writing books. But it does give you a sense that it's possible to do things. A life is never over unless you want it to be. What is the use of beginning a task which we have so little chance of finishing? Or even if we ourselves should happen not to be interrupted by death or military service, why should we, indeed how can we, continue to take an interest in these placid occupations when the lives of our friends and the liberties of Europe are in the balance? Is it not like fiddling while Rome burns? Then he makes the point which made me think about this essay again and realize that this is something we have to renew to ourselves regularly. We shall not be able to answer these questions until we have put them by the side of certain other questions which every Christian ought to have asked himself in peacetime. I spoke just now of fiddling while Rome burns, but to a Christian, the true tragedy of Nero must be not that he fiddled, while the city was on fire, but that he fiddled on the brink of hell. And then he apologizes for using the word hell because he says, of course I realize that that one-syllable word is not a popular word in theology, and it's embarrassing to use it because most ministers don't like it. But he said, from this pulpit, I'll just have to use it, having no other authority than our Lord himself. He said, people will tell you it is St. Paul, but that is untrue. These overwhelming doctrines are dominical, and by dominical he means Dominus or Lord. They come from the Lord himself. They're not from one of his apostles. They are not really removable from the teaching of Christ or of his church. If we do not believe them, our presence in this church is great tomfoolery. If we do, we must sometime overcome our spiritual prudery and mention them. It is interesting to consider that hell is considered, that he used that as something that you, if you're a little prudish, you don't ever talk about it. Well then, we must come to the point that every Christian who comes to a university or any place of learning must at all times face a question compared with which the questions raised by the war are relatively unimportant. He must ask himself how it is right or even psychologically possible for creatures who are every moment advancing either to heaven or to hell to spend any fraction of the little time allowed them in this world on such comparative trivialities as literature or art, mathematics, or biology. To admit that we can retain our interest in learning under the shadow of these eternal issues, but not under the shadow of a European war, would be to admit that our ears are closed to the voice of reason and very wide open to the voice of our nerves and our mass emotions. And I think most of us will have to say that when there's a threat of nuclear war, when the Second World War started for us in this country at a different time from that of Europe, of course, when the environmental challenge became very real and still is, at once we begin to say, well, we must be up and doing. We must have a mind for the fate of the planet. We must do this and this and this. And why? I mean, why do we? What does that have to do with our human beingness and our relationship to eternal truth? If it's only an imminent threat that causes us to stop and think, then that threat must be the reason whereby we live. And it's not a matter of our living in terms of in the presence of God, or sub specie aeternitatis, which is a phrase that always grips me, the fact that you really do live in the dimension of eternity, or you don't. Now, I'm afraid most of us don't, so that when there is a war, that's the real thing. Or if there's a possibility of swine flu, that's the real thing. The reality of eternity being actually present with us as in this room right now, that's a kind of a, take it or leave it. I don't have to think about it if I don't want to. We really are really much open primarily to our nerves and our mass emotions. The war creates no absolutely new situation. It simply aggravates the permanent human situation so that we can no longer ignore it. Human life always has been lived on the edge of a precipice. Human culture has always had to exist under the shadow of something infinitely more important than itself. If men had postponed the search for knowledge and beauty until they were secure, the search would never have begun. We are mistaken when we compare war with, quote, normal life. Life has never been normal. Well, he says, plausible reasons have never been lacking for putting off all merely cultural activities until some imminent danger has been averted or some crying injustice put right. But humanity long ago chose to neglect those plausible reasons. They wanted knowledge and beauty now and would not wait for the suitable moment that never comes. The insects have chosen a different line. They have sought first the material welfare and security of the hive, and presumably they have their reward. Men are different. They propound mathematical theorems in beleaguered cities, conduct metaphysical arguments in condemned cells, make jokes on scaffolds, discuss the last new poem while advancing to the walls of Quebec, and comb their hair at Thermopylae. Now, this is our nature, and it's true. In prison camp, we did not simply talk about the rumors of how, when we were going to be let out, how terrible the Japanese were, how hungry we were, and all that kind of thing. If we had, we would have, many more of us would have been fatally ill before the end of our 3 or more years of imprisonment. We did discuss metaphysical questions. We did argue about doctrines. We did discuss books. We did talk about a lot of things. We even had a little session in Norwegian periodically, so we wouldn't forget that language, important as that is to Carol. You know, we have to keep up on some things. And some people kept on reading Greek. Some people learned Hebrew. There were a lot of things going on with the heads of people, as well as with their hands. And certainly we did not use our conversation simply to talk about the problems of what might or might not happen to us. Now that is living in the threat of an imminent threat, and yet being able to realize that you are a human being. Now this is, as he says, this is what all of life is. It's not any different. He says, for instance, many people will say, how can you be so frivolous and selfish as to think about anything but the salvation of human souls? And we have at the moment to answer the additional question, how can you be so frivolous and selfish as to think of anything but the war? Now, part of our answer will be the same for both questions. The one implies that our life can and ought to become exclusively and explicitly religious. The other, that it can and ought to become exclusively national. I believe that our whole life can and indeed must become religious in a sense to be explained later. But if it is meant that all our activities are to be of the kind that can be recognized as, quote, sacred and opposed to, quote, unquote, secular, then I would give a single reply to both my imaginary assailants. I would say, whether it ought to happen or not, the thing you are recommending is not going to happen. Before I became a Christian, I do not think I fully realized that one's life after conversion would inevitably consist in doing most of the same things one had done before. One hopes in a new spirit, but still the same things. Before I went to the last war, I certainly expected that my life in the trenches would, in some mysterious sense, be all war. In fact, I found that the nearer you got to the front line, the less everyone spoke and thought of the Allied cause and the progress of the campaign. And I'm pleased to find that Tolstoy, in the greatest war book ever written, records the same thing, and so in its own way does the Iliad. Neither conversion nor the enlistment in the army is really going to obliterate our human life. Christians and soldiers are still men and women. The infidel's idea of a religious life and the civilian's idea of active service militarily are fantastic, fantastically crazy, actually. If you attempted in either case to suspend your whole intellectual and aesthetic activity, you would only succeed in substituting a worse cultural life for a better. You are in fact going to read nothing either in the church or in, you are not in fact going to read nothing either in the church or in the front line. If you don't read good books, you'll read bad ones. If you don't go on thinking rationally, you will think irrationally. If you reject aesthetic satisfactions, you will fall into sensual satisfaction, and that is that. Well, I think the point is clearly taken, then, that there is a sense in which we need to continually assess our own lives as being not any different than if we were living in wartime or any other, you know, big time, historically speaking, but realize that time is time, and we are living in it in a specific dimension with eternity, if that's where we're at. I think he's very good in this paragraph, and I'm going to take the time to read it, because I don't know whether this book isn't always easy to get at. It's this particular sermon is in Lewis's Weight of Glory. It happens to also be in a little volume called Fernseed and Elephants, which is a reprint of some of his sermons and essays that were not too available before. It's for a very different reason that religion cannot occupy the whole of life in the sense of excluding all our natural activities. For of course, in some sense, it must occupy the whole of life. There is no question of a compromise between the claims of God and the claims of culture or politics or anything else. God's claim is infinite and inexorable. You can refuse it, or you can begin to try to grant it. There's no middle way. Yet, in spite of this, it is clear that Christianity does not exclude any of the ordinary human activities. St. Paul tells people to get on with their jobs. He even assumes that Christians may go to dinner parties, and what is more, dinner parties given by pagans. Our Lord attends a wedding and provides miraculous wine. Under the aegis of his church and in the most Christian ages, learning and the arts flourish. The solution of this paradox is, of course, well known to you. Whether you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. Therefore, all our merely natural activities will be accepted if offered to God, even the humblest. And all of them, even the noblest, will be sinful if they're not. Christianity does not simply replace our natural life and substitute a new one. It is rather a new organization which exploits to its own supernatural ends these natural materials. No doubt in a given situation it demands the surrender of some or of all our merely human pursuits. It's better to be saved with one eye than having two to be cast into Gehenna. But it does this, in a sense, just accidentally, because in those special circumstances, it has ceased to be possible to practice this or that activity to the glory of God. There is no essential quarrel between the spiritual life and the human activities as such. Thus, the omnipresence of obedience to God in a Christian's life is, in a way, analogous to the omnipresence of God in space. God does not fill space as a body fills it, in the sense that parts of him are in different parts of space, excluding other objects from him, yet he is everywhere present, according to good theologians. Well, I wanted particularly for you to think about that one statement that he makes when he says that Christianity does not simply replace our natural life and substitute a new one. It is rather a new organization which exploits to its own supernatural ends these natural materials. The reason I want you to think about that is that it has a great deal to do with the concept in Charles Williams's writing. One of the great principles that Charles Williams used and lived with was the concept and use of the image. Now, imagination has image within it. You all realize that. Now, image itself in writing is something a little bit different, because an imagination can use a lot of different things to go off on its own way and bring these airy nothings, as I said the other day, into some kind of local habitat. But image, in the way in which it is used by Williams and the Inklings, these people that all belong to this group of writers that Lewis and Tolkien and Williams and Dorothy Sayers are a part of, has a peculiar significance. And as I was thinking about this, I was trying to see, now, where does this fit in to something that is concretely ours in our particular living? All of you know the meaning of the word, I assume, imago Dei, the image of God. We are created in the image of God, right? Now, does that mean we are an image? Does that mean we are a graven image? Does that mean we are just an imaginative thing? We have a life of our own. We are created in the image of God, but we have a life of our own. We are his production, in a sense, his imaginative production. Okay. Does that mean we're not real? Does it mean that you and I don't have actual lives, decisions to make, free will? No, I mean, we all say, I know that's true. We do have that. Very well, then. Then why should it be hard for us to understand that, for instance, if a novelist is writing and he is using an image, the concept of an image in order to write his novel, that image has a life of its own. In other words, the novel with the plot, the characters, the place that these people live, the situations that they get into, are all exciting, adventurous, or dull, or boring, as the case may be, but they do have a life of their own in and of themselves. Whether they relate to a deeper meaning or not is another side of the coin. But the main thing to realize is there is an ongoing kind of story here that is independent of anything else. All right. Now, Charles Williams believed this very strongly, and all of his novels have that kind of a storyline. Actually, this is also true of Lewis. Any of you who has read the Narnia books knows that those stories, a lot of people, fortunately, can read them without knowing that they have anything to do with Christianity. I say fortunately because if they thought they had anything to do with Christianity, they wouldn't read them. So, you know, it's a very good thing that they don't obviously have anything to do with it. And yet, on another level, they are completely bound up with the truth of Christianity. And this is also true of the novels of Charles Williams. You do not see these truths, you know, spelled out for you in neat little outlines and defined with careful description so that you won't get off the track. No, indeed. But are your lives so well defined? Are mine? So that everybody, when they see us, oh, I can see that's Christian truth walking there. Oh, no. I mean, I don't think so. I don't think they think so when they see us. You know, they see your name and they see my name and sometimes they find out what we're about and where we're at. Sometimes they don't. You can't really tell by the way somebody asks for something over a counter always. So there has to be a little bit more in the whole storyline of the person before you're able to tell, because we don't all believe in signs. We don't all believe that just because somebody wears a cross that indicates that person is in fact a Christian. So there is more to the way in which Christian truth is expressed and incarnated in this world than simply in terms of the doctrines that we also are also important, or like a sermon like this, or sermons that we hear, Bible studies, what have you. They are all important, but they don't take the place of the image idea, which is the life of a person or persons in a story or a poem that has a life, have lives of their own, have stories of their own, and yet on another level are deeply related to the truths of God in Christ. Now, this is what Charles Williams is most specifically about in his writing. And what I just read from Lewis here is so true of all of his writing, because he, as he says, he does not replace our natural life and substitute a new one, but it's a new organization which exploits to its own supernatural ends these natural materials. In other words, the novels and plays and poems of Williams, all of them have this interior organization of a deep Christian involvement, of a deep sense of being lived in the presence of eternity, in the presence of God. Now, this is it's hard to grapple with, but why we think that eternity is such a simple matter to deal with, I don't know. I was reading last night about that, oh, Kierkegaard was saying that maybe we should realize that our worry is that God might ignore us instead of always feeling like, oh, well, when I get around to it, I'll pray to him. And I thought at the when I was reading him, I thought he was using it simply as a shock method. He said, maybe people ought to be shocked into thinking that God is God, and there is something here to deal with that is not just something to be pocketed. And I thought to myself, you know, that maybe that's some of the angles that Jesus was referring to in the parable of the man that knocked on the door, and the man, and also the unjust judge, and all those stories that Jesus told about, don't ever stop praying, keep on pounding the door, beat it down, as Luther says, kick it in. And this kind of relationship, sometimes we become so casually familiar with God that, well, it's, you know, any old time. And if we live long enough, we'll have plenty of time, of course. And Lewis's point, of course, is that living in the threat of wartime is no different from any other time. Our normal life is never normal. We never have any kind of idea how long we're going to last. We only have today. And when you start thinking that way, then some of these writings of the Inklings actually begin to grip you with a new kind of meaning, because you begin to see in them some of the truths that you have sort of buried and allowed to go to sleep. As one of my favorite quotes from Coleridge, I think it is, who says that truths of all others the most awful and mysterious, yet being at the same time of universal interest, are too often considered as so true that they lose all life and efficiency of truth and lie bedridden in the dormitory of the soul, side by side with the most despised and exploded errors. In the dormitory of the soul, these really radical truths lie sleeping right next to errors that are also sleeping there. And they don't have any life anymore for you or for me. And this kind of thing is what these books and these writings of this particular English group of writers, is what they are set about to do, is to awaken those truths again so that they have an efficiency and a life. And they're no longer so casually familiar that we can go to sleep with them. I'm going to suggest one book of Charles Williams, not that I think it's a particularly good book for you to start reading, but because it has a kind of an interesting image in it, and perhaps it will help you to understand the general idea of this kind of writing. he wrote a book called Many Dimensions, and in that book, a very famous stone, well, it was famous in mythology and legend, not famous in the newspapers or in 20th century society, but this stone was from the original crown of one of the ancient kings of the world. Well, the stone got into the possession of some, I think it was a Turkish embassy, and somebody got a hold of it. One of the characters in the book gets a hold of it. And the problem with the stone is that it has such power that when you hold it, you can go from here up to Holden Lake, you know, just by rubbing it. Now, that's quite a ways to get in a hurry and disappear for a time, and if you hold on to the stone, you can get back again. The problem is that some people were put someplace by people using the stone, and then they were left there, and they were forgotten for quite a long time. They had a hard time getting out of where they were, because when you when you use that stone very often, you could also stop time and everything else. And that's a very bad situation to be in if you're not in control of it. One poor fellow in here has a, as I say, is really imprisoned in a very difficult situation. The situation continues and continues and continues, and he can't get out of it because people who had control of the stone forgot about him and left him there. Well, that's the kind of stone it was. There are two people in the novel. One who is a lord and has a great deal to do with the foreign office and whatnot, and his secretary, who is a real Christ figure in the book. Their relationship with the stone is one kind of relationship. Then there's a mayor of the town who wants to get a hold of the stone so he can clean up his town and get a lot of things taken care of, and he has another relationship with it. Then there's another man who's afraid that if the stone gets used, it'll destroy his airplane industry. Well, of course, you know, could if you got many stones like that. Well, you know that, and then that's exactly what he foresees and says, if I can just get rid of my airplane stock and I could start manufacturing these stones, I could really go to town on it, and, you know, we could all have our little stone and we could get around. Now, the things that are involved here are the kinds of things that you have to start thinking about when you read the book. It's a really adventurous story when you read it straight through. Pure and simple. It's just exciting. And you really get nervous. You get nervous about all these books, so I don't recommend them to everybody because they are kind of frightening. But I'm just going to tell you about this one so you understand it as an illustration of the use of the image. But it just simply as magic, as a magical kind of a talisman, the novel is exciting. It's an adventure story. Well, then after you read that story the first time, you go back and read it again, and you remember what I said last time about the importance of rereading things if you really think they're worth something, then they're worth rereading. And when you read it again, you realize that there's something more, there's a lot more in this relationship than meets the eye. Well, some of the things are very apparent. As I said before, there's the use and misuse of power in the relationship of the stone. Just as the stone is an image of the whole material universe. It's the misuse of our universe, of our planet, of everything that we've got, that really destroys us because what word have we heard more than anything else in the last few years? We've exploited the planet. Well, this is exactly what these people, what Williams was talking about, and this was way back in the 40s that he wrote this, long before we did a lot with environment and ecology. This is what was happening. If the great gifts of the material universe are exploited for our own misuse, if they're not stewarded and cared for and tended, you know, they're going to destroy us. Then, as I mentioned, the idea of the stone simply as monetary value. It's a way to make money. And then this whole chain of economic relationships develops. And what is this thing of supply and demand in our human life? What is it about human beings that we've always got to be wanting and wanting and wanting and more and more and more and not realizing that less than all will not satisfy a man? As Augustine said. And that's in it, because the stone, you know, becomes a dominating thing. You've got to really be able to proliferate it and make it make money for you, because it can be, this is not just a sense of power from the point of view of its magical power, but it's going to really, you can buy stocks, you can have a company, you can have an interlocking directorate. You know, well, you can have somebody in China and somebody in representative in Europe and somebody in the United States, and of course the head office will be in England. Well, you know, that's another way in which the stone is an image of something that's available to us as human beings. And then the stone has the sense of all the relationships that we have with some symbol of God's power. A kind of the relationship, for instance, that the secretary, the young girl who is really the closest to a Christ figure, is her name is Chloe Karen. And she is a really lovely person. And her relationship with the stone is such that even at the threat of being destroyed by it or this person who may get control of it, she will not use it for her own satisfaction or even to save herself. Now, I don't know if you remember the words, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That's the line that came to me. It's never mentioned in here. I don't even know if Charles Williams was using that in his subconscious or conscious mind. And that's the wonderful thing about this kind of writing, is that it allows you to be a creator with the writer. You bring to that novel all the biblical, religious knowledge you've got, all the worldly knowledge you've got, all your experiences, and you throw it into this cauldron of story that he is producing, and you too are writing the book with him. It's your novel too. And that's what makes it, to me, really exciting writing. It's not just all there. Well, that was a good book. Bang. Thank you. I'd like another one, but not that author, please. And that's it. You know, you really are not through with that novel when you finished it at the last page. Now, that kind of writing to me is takes hold of something other than what, in general, we have assumed to be Christian, quote, Christian literature. Because it does do for us what God does for us. He allows us a lot of free will and choice and selection and says, go ahead and live your life. But if you want to live it, you know, in relationship with me, then there's going to have to be a reorganization someplace. Now, none of these people in this novel, I think there may be two, who are really positively affected by the stone. Lord Arglay, who is the sort of the chief proponent of kind of a neutral position, but sympathetic with his secretary, and really falls in love with his secretary finally, I better not tell you what happens to her, but anyway. He just thinks she's a wonderful person, and she is. But she is, in a real sense, a Christ figure, so that her presence all through the book is always a redeeming factor in every situation. She doesn't quote a single Bible verse, nor does she say anything specifically. But my goodness, you know, if you're a Christian, you should be able to, and I should be able to, understand these relationships and know what they are. And this is what Charles Williams assumed. That's one of the exciting things about his writing, as I see it, is that it always leaves you with some unsolved riddles. And none of his books have a solution. And some of them are much worse than others. And sometimes one book will be solved in another book. But it just depends on how you happen to read it. So nobody tells you, oh, you'll find the answer in The Place of the Lion. Oh, no, you won't. Because you might not find the answer there. You might find it in All Hallows Eve. You see, it's your identification and your understanding and your background that's going to put something into it. Now, a lot of people felt and do feel that he does get wordy. Well, Luther does too, you know, and a lot of people do get wordy. But his tangents and his sort of divergences from the original plot line are really important. In All Hallows Eve, there's a description of the City of God. Now, this book takes place in London. The amazing thing is that two of the characters are dead, and the rest of the characters are alive, and yet they are, you know, relating to each other every once in a while. They call each other up. At least the dead people call the living people up. Really, really scary. But it isn't, this isn't an astral body. This isn't some kind of ghostly thing. This is simply the image of the continual, eternal presence of God. That we live in the eternal now. And that the city of God is now, as well as in the future. But as far as God is concerned and we are concerned, as I mentioned earlier, there is just today. And certainly the scripture gives you that sense all the time. We have history on our planet, and we have that to relate to. But in terms of our relationship to God, fortunately, he does deal with us as of the present. And the sense you get from Charles Williams's writings is that God is eternally present with us now. He isn't parked off someplace, you know, back in, you know, century 1 AD. That his incarnation and his death and crucifixion and resurrection and ascension in the life of Jesus Christ is not just an historical event way back there, but that the effects of it and God's presence are present to us now. Otherwise, how do we understand that we believe in the what we say in the creed, that he sits at the right hand of God? I mean, if he's not present as of right now, you know, why do we put it in the present tense? Why don't we say he sat at the right hand of God? That's what it says, isn't it? Isn't that what the creed says? Mm-hmm. Goodness, you know, I have a blank. Is that right? I can't even put those words in my head right now. But he sitteth is very handy. Gives it a very good kind of a non-understandable time, you know, put it in, but it's true that I think that's one reason we have trouble with it, because we don't realize it's a present tense, and that is could be written over all of Charles Williams's books. He sits at the right hand of God. God is in the present. He's eternally present, and Jesus Christ is eternally present to us, and these people that live and move in through all these novels are continually being interrupted by Jesus Christ. Not in some kind of a holy private meditation, but their lives are interrupted. The situations in which they live are interrupted. They're continually being given challenges and odd accidents and strange situations. And you say, well, but those things aren't going to happen to me. Well, you know, maybe they don't look like that to you, but somebody else, if they read your story, might think so. You know, what you and I go through looks like one thing to us, but if somebody were reading about us, you know, we might make a pretty good novel too. And this is what you sense from Williams, is a direct kind of confrontation and involvement with the eternal God. It's there all the way through. And lest you think that this is a kind of an off-spiritualization of life, it is not. The incarnation is the central fact of all of his writing. And of all of the writing of all of these people, simply because of the fact that they realize that only in the incarnation do we understand truly what it means to live in, with, and under another person. This is what Jesus did in the incarnation, and this is what you and I do, as Williams shows continually, and we'll develop that a little bit more tomorrow when we talk about his concept and understanding of co-inherence, in which you and I not just bear one another's burdens, you know, and so fulfill the law of Christ, but understanding that bear one another's burdens means living into another person's life if he wants you to or if she asks you to, in such a way that you really do carry that person's life when that person is exhausted. Now this happens very clearly in the novel Descent into Hell, in which one of the characters, Peter Stanhope, carries the fright of a doppelganger a psychic factor in a young woman's life. He literally carries it for her so that the fear of it is no longer there. Now this, William says, is what it means to really live the life that Jesus expects us to live for one another. That we truly do live so totally into our neighbor that what he suffers, I suffer. And I can help him by bearing that for him for a time, and he can walk with some freedom and lightness and ease because I'm willing to bear that burden, and it's something that I really know that I'm carrying. And that kind of life is a life that is not a casual familiarity. You soon find out that the truths are no longer sleeping in your soul because they start pounding for to get out and get out into the light. And that's the excitement of the life of the imagination when it's read and understood in terms of some of these particular writers. It's true in many, many writers, but I think these particular writers are available and have something particular to say to our century. I have one person here, Kurt Reiser, who was here last year and who is a Williams reader. And I don't expect you to give a testimony, Kurt, but I would like to have you just mention maybe which novel you like the best.
I haven't read any other than Descendant of
Hell. Oh, The Descendant of Hell.
No, frightening.
That was what?
Frightening.
Frightening.
I stayed up with Steve.
Yeah.
Last year we stayed up all one night and read that book and ran across the hall to each other. I see this connection here and oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? I never thought about that before. I guess we frightened each other too.
Yeah. And then we had a discussion on it about, was it the next week? Or I guess you were still in the process. They were trying to cover an awful lot of reading in one short time, and I think that's one reason we're starting a little earlier this year, so you do have a chance, if you want to read more than one of the Charles Williams novels. Those of you who are on Lifestyle, you do have a little more time to think about that. But I mentioned at that time the importance of reading, two of you reading the same books, you could share it and talk about it.
That one thing about the girl, what was the girl's name that Sam Pauline?
Yeah, Pauline.
About doing something for an ancestor.
Mm-hmm. That was strange.
I never understood that really. But
no, but that...
How the co-inherent,
yeah.
It transcends...
it transcends ages. Time. Mm-hmm. This is mainly... now, that side of it, I admit it, I didn't see that either, but that, again, is the image idea. This, you don't take these books as actual fact. I mean, this is true. Now, this is just like the Bible, you know. We know this is true because he's writing it. This is an image kind of thing in which you understand that he's writing an entertaining story, a novel, an adventure, whatever, a mystery, whatever it may be. But what he, underneath it, you really sense that what he is concerned about is that all of our lives are related as an immediate thing to God, that for God there is no past, present, or future. He's always present. And we know that from all our theology, that God is present. That the time, as we know it, is a planetary thing. And that God, you know, deals with us as nowness all the time. And in that respect, you do get this kind of thing comes in simply to make it even more apparent that we are surrounded with a great cloud of witnesses. And this is not just an imaginary thing. And Jesus refers to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob as present people to him. He's aware of them continually. He's aware of all of the past, and yet he says, before Abraham was, I am. You see? Jesus is beyond and above and transcends all that kind of structure. And yet, at the same time, we know that from our point of view, we always have this now relationship with God, so that there's a continual access to him, and he has on his side continual access to us, so that your life is going to be full of surprises, and they can be terrifying and risky, but never dull.
I just read that part of Descending.
Would you? Can you speak a little louder?
I just read the part of Descending the Hell that you were referring to, about where this artist, this poet, says he will take this woman's burden.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was reading it, what I was kind of amazed by was how he told her he would take it. He insisted on taking
yeah.
it. Whereas when we think of carrying one another's burdens, we think of, at least I do, I think of it in terms of a kind of a silent suffering alongside, but you
yeah.
don't say to that person who's suffering, give it to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You still have to face it, but give me your fears,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I can carry them, because
mm-hmm.
I don't have to face the thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting, because it was such a, to actually tell the person
mm-hmm.
that you were doing this for them
mm-hmm.
makes a big difference. You know, it's not necessarily, although I think being far away from someone and praying for them or thinking about them and what they're going through is sometimes the most you can do, it's also a really good thing, I think, to tell a person
mm-hmm.
that you're doing this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
If they'll give it to you.
Yeah. Well, there's a real thing here involved in, see, this is where we are Christ for each other. In Williams's novels, these people are being Christ for each other when they do this kind of thing, because if a person is freed of his sins and his burdens, then is he supposed to just skip around and not help anybody else? No, you know, you naturally the feeling is, I, you know, if there's need, I want to help. And well, last winter we talked about this once at Vespers, and I suggested that sometimes if you've been praying and praying and praying for about something and you just feel like you're up a wall on it, you hardly feel like you can pray about it anymore, I said, you can, why don't you tell somebody? You've prayed yourself out. And that person can take over and pray for that for you for a while. I mean, why are we so picky-unish and fussy about these things instead of dealing with them conversationally? As if they were something that you only speak about them in hushed tones and then in church. And you stop to think of how much of Jesus' speaking was done on the wayside and at a variety of outside picnics and casual parties.
I have carried many burdens of people and different ones in my family.
Well,
and
yeah.
And I have found results and returns.
Well, and I
God
think
answered.
That's true. Yeah, and I think it's true that you, it's not, but it's not something you take lightly. And I'm sure that Mrs. Kangas didn't do that,
mm-hmm.
didn't take it lightly.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't. I mean, we always in our family we are so aware of what their troubles are. But it's sometimes our friends or somebody you don't even know very well. If you're praying about the people that the Lord is going to bump you into, you know, those are the people that maybe desperately need some help. Just like this in this Descend into Hell, this girl was simply taking the part in an amateur play production, and the man that took over that wanted to take over her burden just observed her. Because he had the eye of faith and could be concerned, he finally asked her what was troubling her. She wasn't related to him. He didn't even know her, except as he had observed that she had an anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, this is what I mean by God's eternal nowness to us, so that it's a present thing. It's not something that's going to happen next week. And, well, anyway, you don't have to worry about all of you trying to find Charles Williams. That's not necessary. But do read the Narnia books.